My guest today is yet another person who has been, well, going against the current of the mainstream discourse on a very important topic, and one that is maybe repressed more than any other, at least in Europe. That is the issue of the revisionists, who argue that some, many, or almost all of the claims in the mainstream Western account of the Nazi Holocaust are inaccurate, flawed, tendentious, or just plain wrong. And there have been more and more people out there like that over the past couple of decades, and they've gotten more and more flack from the mainstream. I think since 9/11, it's been a bit harder for these people because they get lumped in with the evil terrorist enemy of the wonderful Jews and Americans, who were, of course, the heroes of World War II, and the evil Germans were the enemies, and, of course, now the Arabs and Muslims are just like the Germans. I mean, that's pretty much what they're trying to tell us in the mainstream media. A whole lot of that is wrong, and Nick is one of those people who say we need to go back to World War II and get a handle on what really happened there, specifically with the alleged mass extermination program. The many revisionists out there say that there's really no strong evidence that there was an attempt to completely exterminate Jews, gypsies, or other so-called undesirables, and that the so-called death camps were mainly work camps, and that the horrible suffering and tremendous death did occur there, but mainly due to disease and starvation, not mass murder in the kinds of quantities that are claimed by the mainstream discourse. Well, you know, I never used to give this argument the time of day, but I kind of gradually got sucked into it, and I've been reading about it, and I think it's a very interesting controversy. And so let's welcome Nick Kollerstrom, a historian of science who was chased out of the University College London for writing an article on this topic. Welcome, Nick.
Hi there, Kevin. Yeah, it's great to be back on your show again, and I accept the summary you just made. A bunch of us British revisionists, we enjoy getting together and talking about the subject, and we decided to set up a website, which we've now done, on Holocaust Memorial Day, which is the 27th of January, called whatreallyhappened.info, okay? And the distinctive feature about this site, Kevin, concerns British intelligence decrypts, which were made during World War II, okay? Britons were able to decode the German secret messages, and they recorded messages to and from all the German labor camps for a year, the year 1942, and they kept them top secret for 50 years. And in the mid-90s, these messages, decryptions about everyday life in the German labor camps, were released and made public. They're in a public place called the Public Record Office, which I and my friend have been going to a bit. And historians have been curiously silent about these documents. They don't really want to know about them. Why not? Well, because they don't show any sign of the Holocaust going on, you know. There's no trace or hint, in my opinion, of any mass extermination program going on in these camps as shown in these decrypts.
No. So these decrypts are actually the German decrypts of intercepted German messages concerning the numbers of people being interned in these camps.
Correct. Yeah, the numbers, and also, Jerry, what's going on? Who's needed? What each camp needs? And who gets transferred here and there? Different ethnic groups are mainly Poles, Russians, Germans, and political prisoners. So the four categories, and we hear about how many of these goes to this and that camp. And there's about seven different camps which they describe in detail, which the most famous is Auschwitz. And what we've done now is simply type out and put up all that stuff on the website. And we've also put the daily records of how many people were in Auschwitz each month. That's up on the website now. So we hope our aim is to enable and permit informed debate on this subject. This is the one and only topic where people in England are absolutely incapable of discussing and don't want to discuss it, and yet they're thrilled by it. They sort of want to talk about it, but it's utterly, deeply forbidden, and somehow it's just a total taboo, you know.
Well, that's exactly the kind of subject I like to talk about on my radio show. My mother wouldn't let me talk about politics, religion, or anything controversial at the dinner table, so I'm taking revenge through my truth jihad here on the radio.
Oh, right. Okay, now, What I was, we were looking at the other day, in the year 1942, in the middle of 42, there was a terrific outbreak of typhus. This is an epidemic disease that hit especially the camp Auschwitz worse than any other. And middle of 42 is when the big Holocaust textbooks say that the final solution began, because there was a lot of horror in Auschwitz. And basically almost one third of the whole camp inmates died in a couple of months through terrific epidemics that swept through the camps. And as a result, after that, they got what they call the special treatment going, which was all the delousing chambers were set up. That Zyklon started being delivered, all clothing and all bedding started having to go through the delousing chambers. That is a cyanide delousing chamber, which kills
all the cyanide. Let's stop right there and explain that concept, because many people have heard that there were cyanide gas chambers that were used to kill huge numbers of people, and that they used this hydrogen cyanide gas known as Zyklon B. And you are a chemist, a historian of science with a chemistry background, and you've written on the chemical tests that were done on the alleged delousing chamber at Auschwitz, and all the mainstream people admit that there were delousing chambers at these camps, and they even have one set up at Auschwitz, and then the alleged human gas chamber at Auschwitz. And what you found, or at least what these other researchers found and you wrote about, was that there was virtually no trace of this blue crust that would form from the use of Zyklon B cyanide gas in the alleged gas chamber, but there's a very thick, thick layer of this crust in the delousing chamber, which suggests
it's not just a layer. The hydrogen cyanide soaks right into the wall. They're totally porous and combines with the iron in the walls, and it's permanent there. 60 years later, it's still there, and you just have to measure the iron cyanide to find out where the cyanide was used in World War II. It's quite simple, really. And it was used massively in these delousing chambers that were set up. And there are no human gas chambers historical that you can go and visit at all. They don't exist. There aren't any. Nobody's ever seen one. But there is a historically reconstructed one that tourists go through, and that has no significant traces of cyanide in the walls.
Now, wait a minute, though, Nick. If that alleged human gas chamber at Auschwitz is a reconstruction, well, of course it doesn't have any cyanide in the walls, but there was an original one that did.
Well, I'll just go over that. There was part of the old walls that they've used in that reconstruction, and they have redone the kind of the ceiling and some bits of it, and they put big holes in the ceiling just so everyone gets the message that's supposed to be where the Zyklon was sprinkled through, whereas there are no authentic buildings with holes in the ceiling. So that tourist reconstructed building is alleged to have has got some walls which are historic, and I would say they're just some sort of washroom adjacent to the crematoria. But the story is that this was a human gas chamber. So if it was, then there should be raised cyanide levels in those old walls. Okay.
Right.
So it's very, very simple. The high levels of cyanide in the walls are from delousing chambers. These are small, and they cannot be confused with what are alleged to be the human ones, and they work very efficiently, killing bugs and delousing clothing. And there's plenty of documentation about these, okay, and why they're constructed and who constructed them, whereas no documentation whatever about any alleged human constructed gas chambers.
And it's very interesting that the historical account has taken the subject with less documentation, the alleged human gas chambers, and exaggerated or blown that up into an iconic kind of mythical theme. And the delousing chambers that all the mainstream historians admit actually did exist have been virtually erased. Nobody ever hears about that.
No. And also it came from torture. The confession of by torturing Rudolf Höss, the commandant of Auschwitz, for 3 days and three nights, a British Army hit team got him to tell this story. And so it's important to understand that the confession whereby the, 2,000 people die in 20 minutes just with gas sprinkled in, and a whole lot of absolutely physically impossible things are stated, that came out from a man totally wrecked by torture.
Right.
And who kind of knew that he was doomed, and his family might be spared if he said the right thing. So it's a shameful.
And that's the main evidence. I mean, the main evidence that's been produced for the gas chambers has been this confession and then also alleged witnesses in the camps. And then there are questions about how reliable the alleged the witness testimony is from the people who claim to have somehow known that these gas chambers existed.
Yeah, well, it's hard to find. I'd rather not go into that whole witness story just now, Kevin. But let's say, as a science historian, I'm interested in physical material evidence and trying to get a sort of what kind of scientific focus can we get on this subject. And could I come on to what we're doing in this website with the Public Record Office documents?
Yes, please do.
Okay, so you can go there now and you can inspect the documents, you can read them, and you can see an account of how the different camps were getting on. And for the year 42, roughly half of all the inmates of Auschwitz were Jewish, and a lot of them did die off in this terrific outbreak of typhus. And what we found with the the decrypts was that they have a daily record of how many people come and go at the camps, and they found that the number of people who leave at the camp that peaked around August, September. These decrypts don't actually give you the number of dead, okay? Not on a regular basis. Now, there's another source, which is called the Death Books, which is published, and Gorbachev released them from the Soviet Union. These are documents which the Russia got when it liberated the Auschwitz camp, okay? A whole lot of very precious documents, and they've got about over 60,000, about 68,000 deaths recorded at Auschwitz in these death books. And these have been published, okay? So these do give you the deaths. And we're interested in putting together those death book records for the year 42 with what we've got from these British decrypts about how many were alive. And the death books show a terrific peak in mortality just around that August-September time and when typhus hit the camp. The Auschwitz camp, and then it drops off later in the year. It goes right down again, as they were getting the protocols in place for coping with the typhus epidemic. As you know, Kevin, you cope with typhus by killing bugs, killing lice, everyone has a shower. You know, everyone's hair gets shaved, all the clothes have to be deloused. That's how you do it. They've got these very stringent protocols, and the deaths came right down later in 42.
So the implication would be that right at this moment, the summer of 1942, when the official story has it that this mass gassing of concentration camp inmates began, that was actually the summer when there was a huge typhus outbreak and they started using Zyklon B to disinfect the clothing, and they forced prisoners, probably they shaved them and took them into showers and deloused them and things like that. And one could see how a revisionist might think that this might have become, you know, might have grown as a sort of an oral history that later turned into these stories of mass exterminations and gas chambers.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, all the stuff published about Auschwitz that people keep coming out, oh, it was hell. I was there and it was hell, you know. Lots of books come out on this. It was hell. I mean, it was absolutely dreadful to see this epidemic and dysentery. People dying with flies, and even before they had to build these furnaces to. This was another sort of nightmare thing. You couldn't bury people at Auschwitz because the ground was totally damp with the three rivers running around it. It was too damp to bury people; otherwise, that would totally pollute the water supply. So, and they had to all be cremated. So they had to build a massive load of cremation ovens, or quite a lot of cremation ovens, to burn all these bodies somehow. Maybe 200 a day or even 300 a day would be dying. They had to install these cremation facilities. Until they had got that, what on earth did they do with all the bodies? So that was a terrible time. And I think later in 42, they got the cremation, as well as the special treatment, they had to get the cremation ovens working to get rid of the bodies. And next to the crematoria, I could just add, they had morgues which were piled up the dead bodies, okay? Now, those morgues were in use and would be piled up with stiffs, okay? Now, it's important to appreciate that because in the big Holocaust textbooks, they claim that those morgues were human gas chambers. Okay, because remember, there's no such thing as a room purposely built to be a human gas chamber. Nobody's ever suggested that, right? That is accepted that there's no design built mass human gas chamber. I mean, the official
story is that these other buildings just got sort of retooled as gas chambers?
Yeah, yeah. As a science historian, I would say that mass human cyanide gas chambers have never existed in human history, nowhere, never, and would be totally physically impossible if you tried to build them. I'll make that absolute statement, okay? And what you had constructed in Auschwitz in the wake of this epidemic was... The crematoria with morgues next to them, and those are long, fairly cold rooms for storage, and the big Holocaust expert was trying to make out that those were actually used as human gas chambers.
And once again, you can see how an oral history could get going that would, naturally, when people are suffering so horribly in these concentration camps where they've been ethnically cleansed, they've been rounded up into cattle cars and sent to these camps where people are dying like flies, and then suddenly there's this gassing going on to the clothes, people are being shaved and forced into showers, and then there are these giant morgues full of bodies with hundreds of people dying every day. You can imagine how that would lead to stories of mass human gas chambers.
Absolutely, yeah. I always say it's like a nightmare kind of waiting, a nightmare kind of image waiting to be, a story waiting to be told, that the people who set up Auschwitz, obviously they didn't intend to have a typhus epidemic and have to build so many crematoria and stuff, but once you had crematoria ovens burning bodies and Zyklon gas chambers delousing all the clothing and stuff, in a nightmare delirium, you could easily retell that story as something very, very different, which is obviously what happened at Nuremberg. And Nuremberg, just producing a tin of Zyklon was enough to imply that human gassing was going on, you know?
Mm-hmm. And this would, you can see how this would also get exaggerated, not just by the people who were there and who saw these horrors going on around them and imagined the worst, but you could also imagine how the British intelligence would get a hold of some of these stories and for the purpose of wartime propaganda, it would be very happy to broadcast any exaggerations that it could get away with.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a really good statement in the middle of 43 from the head of British intelligence, which we're putting up on our site, where he says, look, frankly, I don't believe all this gas chamber stuff, and can we please refrain from putting this into our propaganda, because they were suffering from World War One when there was a blowback of all the diabolical lies they'd made up about Germany had been exposed, right? So the whole British intelligence had this collapsing credibility, and they were worried about putting out the gas chamber stories on the absence of adequate evidence for it. Now, the BBC had been broadcasting just these stories over Poland in 42, the year before. In fact, Kevin, if you read your Anne Frank's diary, okay, you'll see that Anne Frank gets to hear about the gassing from the BBC, right?
When did they start broadcasting them?
Well, in 42, 1942. So around this time,
was it simultaneous with these with the typhus epidemic, more or less?
Well, I would like to be able to answer that, Kevin. I think that's a very interesting question you've asked. My hunch is that the whole damn thing kicked off around that time, August, September 42. The massive preparations for hygiene, for delousing, for delivering cyanide to the camps, for building new crematoria, all that was when the stories kicked off of human gassing.
You know, I can imagine the title for an article about this. The Holocaust was a typhus epidemic.
Well, you've got to be very careful of lawsuits here.
I'm being half facetious about that.
Yeah, I mean, Holocaust means fiery. It means fiery, fiery sacrifice. It's supposed to be something fiery, like what the Israelis are doing in Gaza to Palestinians. That is a Holocaust in the correct meaning of the term.
Well, if they're burning the bodies, that counts, doesn't it?
Well, that is actually how there were terrific myths built up around Nuremberg and afterwards, I think in Nuremberg as well, of huge numbers of bodies being burnt spontaneously out in the open, okay? I mean, this is hard to believe. As if huge piles of bodies could be piled up and then lit. Mm-hmm. And you pour a bit of petrol on them, and oh, what happens? Oh, they burn.
As I understand it, to cremate human bodies, which, of course, is becoming more and more popular here in the U.S. now. I don't want to advocate that as a Muslim. horrible. It's a horrible practice. But anyway, they have to have these very, very powerful ovens that reach, they're highly enclosed. They reach an extremely high temperature. I mean, you can't just burn bodies.
No, exactly. But this is one of the primary myths of the Holocaust. You find it in loads of, I'm tempted to call hula hoax textbooks. Perhaps I shouldn't use that word, of big piles of human bodies burning outdoors. In fact, in Spielberg's film Schindler's List, it happens, right? Magically burning pyres, funeral pyres of loads of bodies. And that, why do they want that? Well, it gave them the name Holocaust, the fiery image of burning bodies.
Okay, Nick, we've reached the midpoint of the show, and we'll be back to pick this up on the other side of the break. I wish I could take calls on this show because, we'll have to get you back on the other show where I can take calls, but this is a fascinating topic, and I appreciate your courage in, even if you're wrong, you're very courageous and you're doing very serious research, and I think people ought to appreciate that. We'll be back in 5 minutes. I'm Kevin Barrett talking with Nick Kallerstrom. Welcome back to the Kevin Barrett Show. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing you all the guests I can find who have potentially important things to say that are not being heard in the mainstream. And certainly my guest today, Dr. Nicholas Kallerstrom, qualifies. He was a respected history of science PhD in the London academic world until he dared to take on the question of the chemistry of the alleged remains of human gas chambers, and as well as the remains of delousing chambers in the concentration camps. And then he was summarily ejected without explanation from his position at University College London. Somebody who was chased out of the University of Wisconsin for doing solid research on 9/11, I can very much relate to Nick, who has actually done great work on the 7/7 London bombings as well. Well, today we're talking about the question of the records about what really happened in the German concentration camps during World War II. And, Nick, let's start out with the issue of the numbers. What are our sources for the numbers of people who were in these camps and the numbers of people who died in the camps?
Oh, the source, Kevin, for who really lived and died in the German labor camps in World War II has to be what now called the Arildsson Archives, and that was formerly the International Red Cross. And over 50 years, all claims go through this Arildsson archive database, and it's gradually built up. And the last time they made a statement of how many total deaths in all the camps, it was 290,000 really lived and died in those camps. Now, they sometimes say, oh, we've got millions of documents. Well, they have got millions of documents, yeah. But that's the number of actual deaths, and about 60,000 of those are from Auschwitz, and there's only three occasions on which the Bad Arildsson made a formal statement of the total numbers. They have not done that in the 20th century, because obviously they'd be put in jail and dismissed and everything if they did. The Holocaust denial laws are much stronger now. So,
a quick question about this, the number 290,000 for total deaths in all of the German concentration camps during World War II. Does that include people who may have starved or died of, related to starvation right at the end of the war, when there was no more food, no more supplies reaching these camps? And then secondly, what were the numbers of people who lived in these camps and didn't die and who got out of the camps and then remained alive? Many of them, of course, to become the Holocaust survivors that we hear so much from.
Well, I think those are good questions, and I wish I could give adequate answers to them. It's terribly difficult to get any real information on this. May I say that the three sources of information, fundamental sources, measurement of numbers, and the other two we've mentioned, there's what's called the death books that have been recently published that came out of the Soviet Union, and those have, just for Auschwitz, they have 68,000 deaths, recorded deaths. Okay.
Is there any data for how many people were actually in the camps altogether, and how many people altogether went into?
There is. That data comes from the British Decrypts, and we've now put it up online. That gives total inmates of each camp. But it only does so for the year 42.
I see.
Okay. Yeah. It won't do so for other years. For example, Auschwitz went up to 30,000 people in the year 42, average about 20 odd thousand. But there are two Auschwitz camps. Altogether, somewhat over 100,000 people arrived in the Auschwitz camp in the year 42. Okay.
Now that's interesting, a rough number. When I had a debate on this show featuring Thomas Dalton, whose book is called Debating the Holocaust, I think it's a good introduction to this topic. It covers kind of the arguments on both sides. I had him on debating Roberto Muhlenkamp and Andrew Mathis, who were kind of ferocious, you know, anti-revisionists. And what they said, and I didn't remember that Thomas Dalton had refuted this, was that the Germans kept very, very accurate and complete records of everybody who went into the camps, and that those records showed many, many millions, and that there, since there are no records of people, that many people getting out, that millions and millions must have died.
No, that's a totally fictional statement, Kevin. I'm quite annoyed by that sort of thing. There are millions, it's only in Hollywood movies or in the Yad Vashem database. If you want a totally fictional database that multiplies the numbers by 20, go to Yad Vashem. It's up on the web, and put in, you can search it, right? Search the number of people who died in Siberia during the war, and you'll get 1,000. So they've got 1,000 Holocaust victims who died in Siberia. And put in Moscow, death in Moscow. You get huge numbers. It's a fictional database. They've got 4 million and soon be 6 million, and that's not what I'm talking about. Okay?
But that doesn't come from meticulously kept German records?
No, it doesn't. No.
I've just
told you where they were. Oh, okay. The meticulously kept ones are the International Red Cross at Arelson Archive. They have access over 50 years. They've gathered access to all the records. And then there are the records that were taken by the Soviet Union that are in their death book. And I think that is just for Auschwitz. And that's got 68,000, which agrees, I think, tolerably well with the 60,000 of the Arelson Archive. Okay. And I would suggest, the trouble is you can't relate those totals, the Arelson totals, to what we've got here on our website, which is just for the year 42. It's not easy to relate to together, but I think you can say that they are compatible. We had in 42, in that year, there was in the region of over between 30 and 40,000 people dying in that camp. I think that is from the death book as well as from the departure records of the British decrypts. And so I think they're in the same ballpark. I think we can begin to get a focus on the real numbers, which I think is really important.
Now, are there people being, in the mainstream history business who are being converted by this, at least privately?
I don't think so. No, absolutely not. No.
I've talked to mainstream academicians a little bit about these things. In Morocco, what I discovered was that every academic colleague I met was telling me that this official Holocaust story is nonsense. And I was kind of shocked at the time to hear that from so many people who had done a lot of reading about it. But even here in the U.S., I've occasionally spoken to fellow academicians. One very, very famous folklorist kind of obliquely suggested that a Jewish guy, that he was quite uncomfortable with the official story of the Holocaust during a conversation. I remember at a party with a student, and the student was a fanatical, sort of official version of the Holocaust person, and she was shocked when this guy didn't support her. So I mean, there seems to be a fair number of people, as with 9/11, who kind of privately doubt the official story here. but may not be willing to put their necks on the line the way you did.
Well, my hope is, Kevin, that this year, 2013, will be the year in which the Truth Movement allows itself to talk about this subject. I mean, it has totally avoided it and censored it to date, but I don't think it should be taboo. I think people should be able to understand this is a fictional narrative generated by British and American military intelligence to ratify what they've done in World War II, and we actually don't need to keep believing it any longer, you know?
And of course, many people find that thought terrifying, but I'm not really sure why, because it does seem to me that this story has been used not to, you know, to say never again and to stop injustices and mass killings from occurring, but it's been actually employed to pump up Americans and Israelis with belief in their own superiority and their self-righteousness and their justification and going out and slaughtering huge numbers of other people who are all being equated with the evil enemies of World War II. It's as if today's, you know, enemies of the U.S.-Israeli Empire are evil Nazis who deserve to be killed. And so it seems to me revisionism would actually lead more to peace than to anything else.
Yeah, I think you and I share in common a passionate, fervent belief in undermining the demonized enemy images which the military use and need for their war. They conjure up these demonized enemy images, and we actually don't need them, you know. We actually want to see other people as they really were. And I think that revisionism is a quest for historical accuracy and exactitude. What happened? It's not an ideology, you know. It's not motivated by any political consideration.
Absolutely right. And I think that typically the revisionists are demonized as being people who have their own evil enemy ideology, and they believe that Jews are the evil enemy and that these evil Jews invented this Holocaust story in order to commit genocide in Palestine and to justify their attempts for world domination and so on and so forth. And there are people, I think, in the revisionist community who are a bit like that or who go way too far in sort of demonizing Jews as Jews. But overall, it's not really about that, is it?
Well, I don't think so. No, I feel we need to get a more scientific focus on the issues. And if I may just highlight one particular angle that's come out from discussion on a CODOL website, it's a revisionist website. The mass murder was alleged to happen through cyanide gas and carbon monoxide. Okay. It was alleged that through diesel exhaust, people were killed from carbon monoxide. And both these gases kill by denying oxygen to the body. In the death process, the body dies without access to oxygen, and in both cases, you get a pink coloration of the corpse. Okay, you get a bright pink corpse. That's a remarkable feature which these two modes of death have in common, and this is highly distinctive. Now, were there any pink piles of corpses in the German labor camps? Certainly not. Did anybody mention them? No. Did anybody photograph them? No. There's no hint of any pink bodies in any German labor camps. In fact, you get somewhat fictional accounts of, it had a blue pallor, blue, because the Zeitung Blau, you know, they thought maybe it was a blue color. Well, it doesn't, actually. And the stories at Nuremberg of blue-colored corpses, a blue pallor, are just, they just totally refute the idea of gassing by cyanide and carbon monoxide.
That's very interesting. Yeah. So people are attributing that blue color that actually comes with cyanide and, you know, the blue walls in
blue
the
walls, yeah,
lousing
yeah.
chambers. So they probably are imagining that this would also turn human corpses blue. But in fact, as you say, it really turns them pink. Are you sure that there are no accounts of pink corpses at all?
Yeah. Well, it's been very thoroughly debated recently on this website that I participate in. And there's you absolutely do not get any accounts of pink corpses. You see, the science only caught up several decades later. For example, all the allegations of death by diesel gassing, one third of all the Holocaust was supposed to be by diesel gassing. The fiendish Germans used their petrol, which was called diesel. And it was only in the 1980s that it was definitively ascertained that diesel does not have enough carbon monoxide in it to kill anyone. It's not a lethal gas. It smells terrible, diesel exhaust, but will not actually kill you. And so the whole diesel gassing story kind of fell apart. But because it was several decades later, all the big textbooks had been written. So the pro-Holocaust people couldn't really move the goalposts by changing it into some other gas, because big books have been written alleging that at Treblinka or wherever, you know, diesel exhaust was used.
Now, did the Germans have regular gasoline exhaust available? Could they have used that?
Well, I don't know, but basically the Allies used regular gasoline exhaust, which was lethal. So presumably that they where the exhaust is lethal. So maybe they imagine that the diesel exhaust could be likewise, but it isn't.
No, but my question is, could the people who are defending the official story move the goalpost by saying that, well, maybe there weren't diesel gassings, maybe these gassings were actually using gasoline?
Well, I don't know. And what they could have done, if there's any intention to do it, they would have obviously used carbon monoxide, which was produced in great quantities in nearby industrial plants, and that would have been the obvious, straightforward, simple way to gas people. Nobody did ever suggest that. That has never been suggested. Historically, it's always been these two gases that have been...
Well, one of the reasons I ask this is, you know, I'm not an expert on this topic, but I have noticed that whenever definitive proof comes along ending one particular version of the Holocaust story, such as when, you know, I think the Auschwitz concentration camp had to change its plaque, which said that 4 million people were killed, and they changed it to say something like 1 point something million were killed.
Right.
So 3 million victims suddenly disappeared overnight, and then what the people behind the official Holocaust narrative did was they said, well, those extra 3 million actually did, they were killed, but they were killed on the Eastern Front by mass shootings, and so they were able to keep their magical 6 million figure. When I first learned, this was the first thing that really got me wondering about this whole story, because how can, you know, 3 million deaths just disappear and then suddenly magically be replaced at exactly the same 3 million figure? That didn't add up, and that suggested to me that there is something kind of magical and mythical about the 6 million figure, that these proponents are willing to do anything to maintain it.
Yeah, well, I wonder if it's basically a religion. I mean, in the Christian religion, you've got a God who dies and then comes back from the dead afterwards. And in the Holocaustian religion, you've got 6 million Jews tragically dying in gas chambers, and then they come back. And they claim the cash remuneration. I mean, how many millions of Jews have claimed cash remuneration from Germany as Holocaust survivors? Well, answer, I think it's about 4 million. I think quite a lot more than that have applied for it. Germany has coughed up well over 100 billion Deutschmarks to paying these alleged Holocaust survivors.
They've paid 4 million people?
Yeah, over 50 years. I think it's hard to get exact figures. But, well, it is, yeah. And there's about 3 million Jews in countries ever occupied by Nazi Germany in Europe in World War II. I think it was about 3 million. That's the estimates from the time.
So you get 6 million deaths plus 4 million survivors. That's more than three times as many people as you're saying even there were to kill.
Well, perhaps there's a special hello maths, you know. Perhaps it functions in some sort of religious sense that's immune from rational debate.
I'm sure you've seen it. There's an Israeli professor whose name escapes me right now who has written about the Holocaust as a religion that's emerged as a substitute for Judaism and to some extent Christianity. And Gilad Atzmon has written about this guy. Again,
I love Gilad Atzmon's stuff. That is so good. Yeah.
Right. And his book. Yeah, there obviously is something religious about the Holocaust story, and you know, I was criticized for pointing out that it's a myth, and you know, technical terms, a myth is just a sacred story, and you can tell what story is sacred because it's the one that anybody who blasphemes against it is going to get punished or get, you know, make people very, very upset, and so we've tried to, well, what are the sacred stories out there? 9/11 has become a bit of a sacred story, although I think those of us who are desacralizing it have had some success. But obviously the story of the Nazi Holocaust is a sacred story or a myth in that sense, because, just look at all these memorials that people kowtow to.
Yeah,
You know, look at what happens to people like you who question it. I mean, you're kind of lucky, I guess, that you're not in a country that sends people to jail.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, but despite that, I think revisionists are making progress. I think there are what you might say milestones of revisionism. For example, it's definitively established that there's no documentary evidence any plan or intention to commit the mass extermination program. Okay. And pro-Holocaust people have to believe that it worked by some sort of meteor of minds or ESP or something, that the German generals somehow were able to function together doing this without anything in writing.
Okay, they admit that there's no Führer order.
Right.
And they admit that there's a paucity of any kind of documentary evidence of the organization of an intentional mass killing program. But they do say that there are some documents. I believe there's one, I forget which document this was, that talked about uprooting which could be translated as extermination or uprooting of the Jews from the territory controlled by the Reich. And don't they argue that that is evidence for an extermination plan?
Well, as you rightly point out, that this trying to misuse words, I mean, there is the Endlösung der Judenfrag, that is the goal or end solution of the Jewish question, which people call the final solution, and that meant the export of Jews, getting them out of Germany,
No wonder the Zionists were collaborating with them. Because
the Zionists were totally collaborating. Yeah, Zionists wanted to get them out to Palestine and start Israel. And there was a deep levels of collaboration of Nazis and Zionists. But that certainly, the final solution certainly was in place. And certainly there was a lot of anger against Jews. They felt they'd had some role in causing World War One or causing Germany to lose World War One. So there was a lot of anger and bitterness.
And that probably should have been directed at the Rothschilds and their friends, not at ordinary Jews.
Yeah, right. But despite that, a lot of Jews saying in Berlin, living there through the war and attending their synagogue, and they could go to hospital if they were in trouble. And the records show that I think they were a lot more afraid of British bombing, British American bombing, than they were of the Nazis. I think there were some Jews who just stayed around and through the war, but there were millions of Jews still alive, millions of Jews still alive after the war in Europe. I'm not very competent to talk about this, but it wasn't just that they were flushed out of Europe. That didn't happen. There was a mass exodus, a kind of diaspora from Eastern Europe. They'd been concentrated in Eastern Europe, and there was a terrific diaspora that came into America and into Israel.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's why it's so difficult to count the numbers. When Spielberg was setting up his big archive of testimonies of the Shoah, he went to 50 different countries to get stories, you see, because they're so spread out. So that's why I would say I would discourage anyone from trying to get a number of how many Jews died in World War II. I would say that is the ultimate number you can't ever find, and don't even think about it.
Right. It's kind of interesting because the picture that you're painting based on, your scientific investigation, it ends up making the Nazi Holocaust look a lot more like the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. That is an event that was driven by a kind of racism, colonialism, militarism, ethnic superiority that targeted these victims and ethnically cleansed them from their homes.
Surely the ideology is identical, isn't it? Of Zionism and Nazism. Isn't that an identical ideology, Kevin? I mean, it's racist. It's racial superiority. It's getting rid of ethnically impure people. It's military expansion by force. I mean, isn't it exactly the same ideology?
It does seem to have a lot of similarities, doesn't it? And it's pretty ironic that the very this ethnic group that was targeted in this particular way during World War II would somehow go halfway around the world and then do the same thing to somebody else, imagining that they're justified by the suffering they experienced. And I wonder how much suffering they'll have to impose on the Palestinians before they decide that, okay, the balance has been achieved. We can relax and live like normal people.
Yeah, poor.
Right. And it's also interesting that this is an issue where in the West, so many countries, people go to jail for it. What's the guy's name? A German fellow that I contacted me back in December. I was going to try and get him on the show before
That's right.
he went to jail. Do you remember his name?
Mahler or something. Mahler. He translated something, didn't he? What he did was a translation.
Right. I think he was going to jail for having translated some historiography. I wasn't able to get him on the show before he had to report to a German prison in the beginning of January. So hopefully we'll get him on after his release date, which is at the end of May. But it's fascinating, you know, how many people have been imprisoned, have lost their jobs for this, like you did. How many people do you think are serving in European prisons for politically incorrect thinking and writing on this topic?
Well, that's very difficult to answer. Germany puts in 10,000 or so people each year on the grounds of, incorrect belief and stuff, but that can just indicate any alleged adherence to National Socialism. It may not be what we call revisionism.
Mm-hmm. 10,000 people a year?
There are huge numbers of people, huge numbers of books that get burned in Germany
now. That's amazing. You know, I have people who are attacking me for going to a film conference in Tehran because they claim that the Iranian government is so repressive of freedom of expression. But honestly, I don't think they're putting, you know, many, many thousands of people in jail every year for trying to write history.
Yeah. There's loads of thought crime, tens of thousands of thought crime trials going in Germany. About 15,000 a year thought crime trials go on. We're not told how many get put in jail, but there is a lot. It's a catch-all phrase, and anyone trying to step out of line in Germany is in dead trouble. Yeah.
Wow. That kind of goose-stepping mentality that we're familiar with from Nazi films, it seems like it's still alive in a different disguise.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, you know, be prejudiced against German people or anything, but that sounds like an awful lot of people going to jail for thought crimes. I mean, here in the U.S.
I wish Germany would declare independence. You see, technically, after the last war, it didn't sign a peace treaty with the four occupying powers, and they... Britain and America wrote its constitution. It doesn't have its own constitution that it's under now, and the constitution written for it makes any doubting of the Nuremberg Holocaust story a crime. And what the world really needs is for Germany to assert its own sovereignty and independence, which maybe it's now trying to do by asking the gold back from America, right? Got a German gold come back. And become an independent nation so that it can make its own decisions and stop putting its historians in jail. Germany really needs to stop putting its historians in jail and not make it a crime to have doubt. You know, that you can doubt this without being, without having secret loyalty to National Socialism.
Very interesting point. At the psychological level, it seems to me there's a kind of an egocentrism involved here, where people need these myths to tell them that they are the chosen people or the good guys, the heroes in the war, our enemies are the bad guys. Yeah, you know, it's almost like a drug, like a cocaine that, you know, juices up the ego and makes people feel good about themselves as they go through their drab daily existence. And I've noticed one of the hard things about 9/11 truth is that if you tell people the truth about 9/11, it blows up their faith in their wonderful leaders and in their the cause of their magnificent wars and invasions of other countries, and they feel bad, and nobody wants to feel bad, so a lot of people just push this away before they even look at it. So I've tried all sorts of ways to sneak this kind of information past people. How do you introduce this topic of questioning the received narrative of the Holocaust in a user-friendly way? I guess maybe being scientific, as you're trying to be, is one approach.
I think the idea of it being a religion and looking at a religion, say the Holy Trinity, that's a Christian religion, and the Holocaustian religion is also threefold. There's three things every good citizen has to believe: that there was an intention and plan to exterminate Jews, that they killed 6 million Jews, and they did it in gas chambers. You've got to believe those three things. So that is the trinity, the triune aspect of the Holocaustian religion. And I think there's many ways in which people sense that it is a religion. because they get it rammed down their throat at school the whole time. I mean, you and I didn't get it at school, Kevin, but now kids get it from about the age of seven onwards.
That's right. You know, I got a little bit of it, as I recall. But, you know, we've reached the end of the show. Let me say, I certainly do not subscribe to any holy trinities. I'm a Unitarian Muslim.
Oh, right.
I believe
in one
God, and that is the God of truth with a capital T, Al-Haq. And that's what we should be pursuing and worshiping, and not any of these other false idols like the official narrative of the Holocaust. Whether or not it's true, we shouldn't be worshiping it. Well, thank you, Nick Kollerstrom. I appreciate your dedication and your willingness to risk your reputation and paycheck in pursuit of truth. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, pleasure to talk to you, Kevin. Yeah.
Okay, likewise. Take care. That's Nick Kollerstrom. He's a leading author on the 7/7 London bombings, and he's doing work now at the website whatreallyhappened.info. Just like the wonderful whatreallyhappened.com, try whatreallyhappened.info to see some of the statistics and intercepts that Nick was talking about. I'm Kevin Barrett. My website is truthjihadradio.blogspot.com. I will be traveling in Iran for the Fajr Film Festival. May be able to still do shows here on Tuesday. Keep your eyes peeled to the radio blog, truthjihadradio.blogspot.com. Till the next one, have a good week.
And most people think you're a nut.
Fringe element out there that believes the U.S. government orchestrated 9/11, that is President Bush and the American military, killed 3,000 people. One of those pushing this theory is Kevin Barrett, who actually taught at the University of Wisconsin this fall.
I don't think this is the proper forum, though, for people that hold extremist views like yourself. Reason
no, you guys are extremists. Fox News is the biggest bunch of extremists on the planet.
And equal people see you as an extremist, and I don't think you're the most appropriate guy to teach that class. My guess
I don't think you're the most appropriate guy to be on the airwaves. Spewing your venom throughout this country. I think you guys should be taken off the airwaves because you
silence the conservative.
I'm not even a teachable, denied reason.